Chapter 24. The Green Isles. Weir's ships were the first to join Cressa's fleet that initial summer. Her captain's predictions proved true. The sailors were loyal to their queen and deeply attached to Lord Ambrice, one of their own. Matwick's hold did not extend to the navy. Sea Ghost, Sea Wolf, Sea Dog and Sea Gull, one by one the ships rendezvoused in Pelagos. Provisioning all these ships did not prove too much of a burden because Green Isles merchants wanted to be rid of the Pelish so much that they sold the quartermasters their goods at cost or even contributed them free. And Clemson still had a sack full of Oro gems. After taking stock of his fleet, Ambrice met with all the captains and outlined strategy, assigning ships to various quadrants of the Turquoise Sea based on their capabilities for maritime combat. The shallow-keeled galleots were best for direct encounters with the Pelish vessels, while the deeper-hulled cogs carried men and provisions. Green Isles fishing boats could not participate in battles, but they scouted ahead, ferried messages or brought captives to Sea Pearl for the Queen to question. Jarrett and Larrett of Solterra would move between quadrants, providing navigational expertise as needed. The campaign began quietly. The ships slipped away from Pelagos one by one as soon as their officers were briefed and their holds provisioned. One dawn in the fall, as Sea Pearl herself was headed back to Pelagos after supervising the engagements in the northeast section of the Isles, Shield Sena knocked on the Queen's stateroom door. "Your Majesty, Lord Ambrice says 'tis something you need to see." Cressa climbed out onto the deck. A fog hugged the waves this morning, but by squinting her eyes, she made out the outline of a great flotilla of oared warships, also sailing in the direction of Pelagos. As the wind blew gaps in the fog, she saw they flew the grey, white and purple colours of her father's realm. The Lothars had arrived. "Look, my heart," said Ambrice, coming over to her with his spyglass. He helped her aim it. "Look at the Grand Roman in the centre. See the lettering, Shark Racer. See the flag." "Oh, Ambrice, my brother has come at last." Because she was queen and Mikkel merely the brother of a king, protocol dictated that he come to her, but Cressa wanted to sail to him directly. To her, the hours until both ships docked at Pelagos stretched achingly long. She drove Piquetta to distraction by trying three different hairstyles and sent Sena and Kinley running with contradictory instructions to the ship's cooks. Cressa had always been closer to Mikkel than Rikkel. Unlike Rikkel, who was proper and polite, Mikkel had been actively kind to his young half-sister. He sometimes took her riding or sightseeing around her foster country. At court events such as balls held in the echoing hall decorated with trophies of narwhal horns and walrus tusks, he watched out for her, making sure that she was both treated with the respect befitting her station and having a decent time. More than once he cut in on a clumsy dance partner or told a drunken lord who was boring her that King Nithanil begged a word with him. Learning swordplay from Mikkel, however, had been a mixed blessing because he was strong in anticipation. Anticipation was the ancient gift of the spirit Lotan to the Lothars. It helped them sense what the wind or sea or a person was going to do just moments before it did it. This talent served them well as a sea-going nation. Most Lothars showed some degree of anticipation, cocking their spear the instant before their quarry came into view or putting their hands out to catch a jug before it slipped off a shelf. No one could explain exactly what alerted a Lothar. They possessed a special ability to sense movement and direction. In Mikkel and the other storied sea masters of Lothar lore, anticipation ran strong. This meant, of course, that no matter how much Cressa tried to surprise Mikkel, he inevitably knew where her sword would end up, even before she moved it.
He always beat her at oblongs and squares, too.
But she didn't care much about winning. The important thing was that Mikkel provided companionship and made sure the kitchens offered her something besides fish stew. He also bolstered Nana's authority whenever she had difficulty getting the foreign servants to follow her instructions. Otherwise, her life in Lothrod in that cold stone keep on a high sea cliff was austere. Her father remained an enigma to her. On one level, she knew he treasured her because his face would brighten like the sun piercing through a clouded sky whenever she entered the room. And each year he would be waiting to meet her ship at the pier, wearing the same beaming smile. But once she had settled in her suite and he had ascertained that the fires were hot enough for her thin blood, Nathaniel had little to say to his daughter. He would visit her rooms each evening before high table and inquire after her health, compulsively tying knots on a piece of sailing rope he habitually carried about with him. King Nathaniel looked so uncomfortable during these conversations that even at an early age, Cressa felt sorry for him. She could not recall him spending relaxed time with her, except for one special day. That day, she had been maybe 10 summers old, had broken with rare bright sunshine and a steady small wind. Her father had sent for her and ordered Nana and his guards to stay behind. Alone, they had ridden down to a small, sheltered bay with tiny waves like gleaming ripples of silk. An extraordinarily cunning 2-person sailboat, bearing her name in elaborate decorative lettering, had sat beached on the sand. Nathaniel had spent the whole day patiently teaching his only daughter how to sail it. When the sun had made the air unseasonably warm for Lothrod, he had smiled like a small boy up to mischief. "Watch out!" he'd cautioned, and then he deliberately sprang to the bow and jumped on the sprit until the craft capsized. Cressa had shrieked with laughter, pulled her soggy hair out of her face and clung to the overturned boat.
"Now what, Papa?"
"Now I'll show you how to right a boat. You may not have the weight yet, but you must learn never to be afraid of the sea. Let go, you're perfectly safe. Lotan has you in its embrace."
They had practiced flipping the craft again and again until he was certain she had internalized the skills. Then she had sailed into shore and her father told her this Princella Cressa was her very own, to sail in this bay whenever she wished. He had covered her with a dry blanket, handed her some seal jerky, flatbread, and a small jug of mead. When they had finished their repast, he escorted her back to Tidewater Keep. His daughter had noticed that with each of the horse's strides, his face lost its softness and resumed its customary glower. He never again spent a full day with her. Often, though, a servant would bring a gift to her suite of interconnecting rooms, a carved toy wooden boat, or a doll's bed made out of abalone shells. When she grew old enough to wear jewellery, she would receive a necklace of sea pearls or a brooch in the shape of a seahorse. Her father never sent a note, but if he observed her playing with his gift or wearing it, the same smile would break through his stern face. With a father so distant, Cressa felt especially grateful to her half-brother and his joking ways. And now, at last, here came Mikkel himself, dressed in grey silks with a dashing purple cravat, asking permission to come aboard Sea Pearl. He had come alone, without any retinue. Cressa rushed to meet him at the top of the gangplank.
"Well met, Mikkel!" she cried.
raising him from his bent knee and clasping both hands in hers. Many years had elapsed since she had last seen him. He wore his steel-grey hair in the Lawther fashion, short on the sides and top, with the plait extending a hand's length down from the back of his head. He had a smallish, neat build. He was still trim, and his sea-grey eyes still bright.
"Well, little shrimp," he said, using his old dear name for her. "You didn't think you could host a naval jamboree and not have us participate, did you?"
"What took you so long?" Cressa asked.
"Oh, you know, the old man. The young old man with his butt on the throne. Cautious. But what be the point of having the best navy in the world if you never let it out to play? Did you really think I'd let the Weirs win all the glory? How fare you, little shrimp?"
"I am delighted now that you are here. Mikil, Prince of Lotharod, may I present my husband, Ambrice, Lord of the Weir ships." Ambrice and Mikil clasped forearms, taking each other's measure and smiling.
"I hear I have a few thousand teases to pay back to you, Prince,"
said Ambrice good-humouredly.
"Ah, no need. I gave them away freely," replied Mikil airily.
More seriously, he added,
"I hear I have years of love and care to thank you for." "No need," Ambrice answered, his gaze moving to his wife. "I've had my reward, and then some."
Cressa had ordered a royal meal prepared to welcome Mikil, and she led him to the canopied dining area that the sailors had fixed on the top of the forecastle. She asked after her kinfolk. Rickhill's wife had delivered of another healthy son. Her father appeared restless since his abdication, spending much of his time fiddling with dioramas of sea battles. Mikil thought that Nathanael's taking a bedwife to warm his bed at night had somewhat improved his disposition. Mikil had inherited from their father the same propensity for gifts, but her brother would seek out the most unlikely presents he could find. After the many tasty courses, while they sipped brandy, and Ambrice, as usual, abstained, Mikil presented her with a box. Cressa opened it expectantly, and then held up hair ornaments made of preserved herring skeletons.
"You don't like them?"
Mikil asked, playing crestfallen.
"Oh, but they're lovely," said Cressa. "Just the perfect accent for my ball gown."
"Oh, if it's formal you crave, then you'd better open this too."
Mikil passed her another box, this one from her father, which contained a hairband studded with tiny purple amethysts. It reminded Cressa of a brooch her mother had worn long ago.
"Father has been working on that band for more than a year, so you had better like it," said Mikil.
"What? He crafted it himself?"
"Oh, for certainty, Lackwit. He always makes all the gifts he gives. When you are king and can afford anything of any cost, gifts have no value unless the value arises from your time and craft." "By the by, what news of the Shrimpella? As you requested, we've proclaimed often and loudly that she isn't visiting with us."
Cressa's happy face turned grave. "She is far from this conflict. Pray the waters she is safe."
"When you see her, give her this."
Mikil produced another fancy box. Inside lay a walrus tusk, intricately carved and polished into the shape of a dolphin. Cressa understood that Mikil had carved this himself, taking great pains.
"She gets a lovely present while I get herring skeletons?"
"Oh, but I put weeks into searching for those herring bones,"
Mikil twinkled.
"Besides, you have already received the best presents. My ships, my men, and me."
"Indeed," Cressa acknowledged.
Eventually, they settled down to talk strategy. The Pelish pirates were more dug in than anyone had realised.
Over 20 years, they had built a network of safe harbours, and they paid a vast network of spies and collaborators to warn them of incipient attacks. The shipmasters excelled at slipping away in the night or in battle confusion. Even with the additional ships that had flocked to the Queen's Banner, Ambrice could not blockade or cordon off 500 islands. And their adversaries knew of slender straits not on any map, so that when Ambrice thought he had them surrounded, they melted away into the fog. Thus, Mickle's additions to the fleet were thrice welcome. Mickle proposed a plan he labelled as Hounds, Rabbit, Snap. Ambrice's ships would chase the pirate galleots. They would flee, thinking themselves safe in their bewildering maze of straits. Lothar ships would greet them at the end of their bolt holes. All of his captains had some degree of anticipation, if not as strong a power as Mickle himself, and he felt confident that they could position their ship so as to cut off the pirates' escape. They would all try to preserve captives, especially high-ranking ones, to be questioned by Cressa. "So," said Mickle, "you finally can do something useful with your talent, little shrimp." "Yes, just in time," her brother rose, grabbing a carafe.
"Will you join me in a libation to Lotan to look favourably upon this campaign?"
Cressa had learned her kinfolk's practices during her many visits. This ritual was practised every time her ship set out for Wirrendale. "Gladly, brother." Putting aside his typical joking demeanour, Mickle strode to the bow of Sea Pearl. He poured a quantity of the wine over the deck rail and into the sea, intoning the prayer in ancient Lothar. Cressa knew the proper responses. They entreated Lotan, so powerful, so cruel, and so munificent, to forgive their trespasses upon the spirit's territories, to hold their ships in a protective hand, and to accept this wine as a token of their enduring reverence and gratitude. After a short stay in port, the combined navy put their new strategy into practice. Mickle's unerring sense of which direction the Pelish would scurry helped counter their enemy's expertise at evading engagements. When rammed and boarded, the Pelish fought back stoutly. Cressa's heart broke when Bashkim, the sea master of her own sea sprite, led one of the boarding sallies, only to die on a Pelish cutlass. Once the Pelish realised that the Weirs had some means of making captives talk, they started to employ suicide attacks. It became common for a lone pirate to set his craft on fire and aim it to collide with an allied ship. A different stratagem had disastrous consequences. A Weir ship patrolling near Sea Pearl gave chase and caught an enemy vessel in its grappling hooks. Before they could board, however, the Pelish used a catapult to launch a straw basket onto the Weir deck. Unafraid of straw, the Weirs just gaped at this missile in confusion. The impact ruptured the container. Angry, black-headed vipers, tongues darting, slithered out at lightning speed in multiple directions. Shield Sina, eager to be in the forefront of the boarding party, stood near where the basket landed. Before she could behead it, a viper sank its fangs into her left calf. Twice. By the time rescuers brought her back to Sea Pearl, her leg had swelled three times its size. Someone had already cut open her pant leg to relieve its constriction, but the internal pressure made the skin on her leg fissure in a dozen places, weeping a clear liquid. Sina screamed hoarsely with each breath. "Cut off her leg if you have to!" Kinley shouted at a healer jittering about the mess table where they had lain her. "It won't help," he shouted in reply. "The venom already travels in her blood, spreading through her body. Look, see her fingers puff too." Kinley turned her fury on her friend. "Fuck you, Sina. Why do you have to be so brave? Why do you always have to be first?
Cena's tongue swelled up and turned black. The venom had reached her brain, so Cressa couldn't connect with her mind to enchant her. When Cena couldn't draw in enough air to scream anymore, she still made pitiful, unbearable moans.
Damn you, Cap! Stop her agony or I will!
Kinley shouted. Captain Clemson pulled Cressa out onto the deck.
I'm going to end this, he said, his hand on his dagger's hilt. She would do the same for any one of us. You should remain out here, Your Majesty.
I want to be with her at the end, said Cressa, reaching for strength she didn't think she really possessed. Cressa laid her hands on both of Cena's temples, while Kinley held Cena's right hand and right arm. Clemson, with scrunched up cheeks but steady hands, struck her heart on his first blow.
After all the overlapping frenzy, the silence throbbed in their ears. Everyone in the room stared at the knotted floorboards, speechless, as blood dripped down the table.
This is too much to bear. Can't I do something? Cressa crossed to Captain Clemson, reaching for brown and bloody hands still rigid around his dagger's hilt.
You will not remember what happened here, she said. Cena was wounded in a raid. We surrounded her at the end, and she died peacefully and with little pain, knowing she was cherished. Now, leave the room.
Then she turned next to Kinley.
She smiled at you and told you you were right, as usual. She shouldn't have tried to go first. You told a joke, and she laughed. You comforted her, and she slipped away, holding your hand on her heart. She told you to take her sword and kill scores of Pelish for her.
Cressa proceeded to the other witnesses and similarly replaced each person's memory of the scene that had just ensued. Left alone in the mess, she swayed for a moment, considering whether she could now safely faint. But the dizziness passed, and eventually she had to open her eyes to face the sad sight. She closed Cena's bulging eyes and smoothed the hair plastered on her sweaty face. Since she had hired two maids, Arletti and Piquetta, Cressa hadn't spent as much time with Cena and Kinley. But she still treasured the connection the three of them had formed on Sea Sprite. Cressa covered the racked body with a blanket and wiped the tears off her own face. She couldn't erase the sight of her friend's swollen and distorted body from her own mind, nor could she stop Cena's rapt form, like so many other fatalities, being slipped from the deck of Sea Pearl into the night waters as her men gathered on deck and a piper played Lament for the Lost. The hide-and-seek strategy continued over long moons. Rotherod sent ships to bolster their forces, and the Free States contributed shiploads of foodstuffs and weapons. Each night, Cressa prayed the next battle would prove decisive enough to allow her to return home and reclaim her daughter. After the Battle of the Muskmelons, the Queen was never allowed close enough to directly observe the fray. But Ambrice would return to Sea Pearl with tales of the Allies' successes. Sometimes he'd be so flushed with victory that he'd entice his wife to their cabin for fevered lovemaking, after which he would narrate a tale of flight and pursuit, hulls rammed and grappling hooks thrown, arrows and swords cutting through the air. Other times he'd sorrow over good men lost, and Cressa would talk softly to him, rubbing his shoulder, trying to share his burden.
2 years into the campaign, the pirates grew more desperate and changed tactics. The Isles banned hair dye, just like all other countries, but the Pelish improvised a way to tint their hair green with plant extracts and disappear into the population. After one sortie, Ambrice returned to Sea Pearl, the muscles around his jaw tight with anger.
"What is it?" Cressa asked in alarm.
"We've figured out how the Pelish disappear," he replied. "They've bought off whole islands. When we close in, they scurry to their rat holes. We beach and question the islanders. They swear they've seen nothing, no naught, no Pelish anywhere about these parts. But a Rotha search party found 2 swift boats pulled up into a river mouth and camouflaged with branches. We burned the boats, but we never found the men. For all we know, they stood right there among the villagers, lying through their teeth about how much they wished they could help us."
"Let me come with you," pleaded Cressa. "I could talk to the islanders. I could discover who's been bribed and who's innocent."
"And be the target for scores of Pelish arrows? No, my heart. We'll bring prisoners to you after they've been thoroughly searched and restrained."
A few days later, they brought her a handful of new Pelish to interrogate.
"Are islanders helping you?"
she asked a trussed-up captive, her fingers lightly touching the back of his hand.
"Aye. Those that can be swayed by money."
"And those that can't be bribed?"
"We take their kin. We tell the greenies that they'd better cooperate or their family will become fish meal."
"You keep kinfolk for leverage?"
"Aye."
"Where do you hold them? On your ships?"
"Nah, we don't want these mewling greenies in our way. We have holding pens."
"Show me where, on this map."
The Pelish mariner pointed out the 2 prison islands, separated only by a narrow causeway. A week later, when a low cloud cover dimmed slivered moons, Don Jarrett, the Green Isles pilot, guided Walrus Racer, while his cousin, Don Larrett, led the Sea Wind to Jade and Jadeling Isles. The Allies caught the bored Pelish jailers by surprise, so Lortha Arrows took down their sentries in the opening minutes of the attack. After a brief skirmish, the Allies freed hundreds of starving hostages from the miserable water pens where they had been kept. The prisoners were in sad condition. The Allies did what they could to succour them and slowly fetched them aboard. The 2 ships and Sea Pearl ferried the freed men and women to Pelagos to access healing centres and reunite them with loved ones. When they reached the harbour, Ambrice and Cressa stayed on board, letting the erstwhile captives disembark first. Watching their kin and countrymen welcome the former prisoners as they came back from the dead provided an unforgettable sight.
That night, heaps of flowers left by grateful islanders on the wharf where Sea Pearl tied up turned the wooden pier into a riot of colour and scent. From her perch on the foredeck, Cressa could see that Weir, Lortha, Rotha and island sailors clapped one another on the back with pride over the rescue mission. Locals accosted all the mariners with hugs and cheers and offered to stand them to drinks. Shield Kinley stood behind Cressa regarding the starlight on the water and listening to the happy clamour from shore.
"This is a good night," she said.